Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
Zirkse, great touch, and this could be a splendid opening goal. Joshua Zirkse, a class act to open this Semillian derby.
Hello and welcome to episode 98 of Serie A Spotlight. I'm your host, Jake. I'm usually joined by my brother and co-host, Matt, but he is in Australia sorting out some personal issues. He should be back in about 2 weeks, but until then, you're stuck with me. And I often wonder and think to myself, what are the fans thinking right now? What are the listeners thinking right now? Oh, we're stuck with this one, the weird one. Oh, thank God it's this one and not the other one. I wonder, let us know, should Matthew stay in Australia? Comment below. Selecting the goal of the week for this week was particularly difficult. It was so difficult, actually, because you had Xerxes' goal, which took the cake at the end of the day, where the first touch with his back heel, he just played the ball perfectly in front of him to give him space to beat his man. Then the feint to drop the keeper and just taps it in like he makes it look so easy, but that's so hard to do, you know. Like, for me, that's the goal of the week. And then you have Scamacca, on the other hand, who scored a backheel goal where he nutmegged the goalkeeper. Absolutely crazy over there. Politano, who headed the ball down past Pellegrino and shimmied past another man and smacked it into the back of the net. Raspadori's amazing free kick. Solé dribbling Dossena and placing it into the back of the net. All incredible goals, guys. I'm going to drop a poll below. If you're on Spotify, if you're on YouTube, please comment below. Let us know which your favorite goal was and why. But yeah, before we get into the action, guys, remember to follow us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube. Check us out. Drop a 5-star rating. And if you really want to support what we do, we have Patreon. It's $3.99 a month to support our content. We'll be using the money to invest in our studio. I'm currently using the studio, fun fact, for the first time. I'm recording here for the first time. I had to actually duct tape a piece of cardboard to the door frame because we don't actually have any doors installed right now. So the funny thing is the ceiling is soundproof, but we don't have any doors. So it totally defeats the purpose. But yeah, this should be adequate for now. Before I get into a detailed analysis of each game, let's just quickly run down the scores. So it all kicked off on Friday with Genoa, Salernitana. That saw Genoa defeating Salernitana with a score of 1-0. Sassuolo Bologna took place on Saturday afternoon. This is a derby in Reggio Emilia. The score was 1-1 over there. Lecce and Torino faced off, seeing Torino winning with a score of 1-0, while Juve struggled to get past Genoa with a score of 1-0. And they did not struggle because of a lack of quality. They struggled because it seemed as though the entire world was against them for this one. Sunday kicked off with a fantastic game, and it's going to be the main game, the first game we're going to be covering. And I don't ever think in Serie A Spotlight history we've started off with a minnow game. And I'm not sure Matthew would agree with this, but thankfully he's 24 hours away, so by the time he gets here, he'll have calmed down. Cagliari 4, Frosinone 3. This will be the first one I'll be covering this episode. Monza 1, Udinese 1, Inter 1, Roma 0 over there. Roma, absolutely boring. And then a good ad for Serie A, Napoli 2, Milan 2. But it did not stop there, as on Monday it kicked off with Empoli 0, Atalanta 3. And then a fantastic clash between Lazio and Fiorentina, which saw Lazio win with a score of 1-0, thanks to a goal at the death by Ciro Immobile.
In a week ablaze with the thunderous clashes of Serie A giants, where legends battled and the net quivered with the weight of their prowess, one showdown soared above all. An unparalleled spectacle of skill, grit, and redemption. Cagliari 4, Frosinone 0. This game saw Cagliari become the first side in Serie A history to come back from 3-0 down past the 70th minute mark.
Yeah, I wish I spoke like that all the time, to be honest. What a game. What a game. 12:30 on a Sunday. If you were doing anything else, like if you were out for brunch, I pity you, because this was the place to be. And it all kicked off with Frosinone absolutely annihilating Cagliari. But don't get it twisted. Cagliari did hold their own and they were always in it despite being down 3-0. It's just that luck was not on their side, and that's why this game particularly was a testimony of determination and willpower and just never giving up, you know, all the cliches. And of course, Essel Ametti, Senia Pavoletti. Now, let's get into the lineups before we get into what happened. For Cagliari, it was a 4-3-2-1 formation with Scufè in goal, Nathan Nandez as the right back, Augello as the left back, Goldaniga and Dossena at the back, with Makumbu, Prati and Deola in midfield, Yankto and Luvumbo playing behind Mancozu. For Frosinone, it was Turati in goal with Lirola on the right, Marchizza on the left, Romagnoli and Monterisi as the centre-back duo, with Brescianini and Berenchea in midfield, Sule out on the right, Baez out on the left, Reiner in the pocket and Cuni up front. It was a cagey start, but Frosinone did start off on the front foot this game, especially possession-wise, but in the 22nd minute the individual errors began as Dossena, who you'll hear a lot about this game, gave the ball away cheaply in a dangerous position. Reiner, the exciting youth prospect on loan from Real Madrid, played Sule, the exciting youth prospect on loan from Juventus. And of course, he finished clinically. What you'll notice about this Frosinone team is they are young and most of them are on loan. It's just crazy how selflessly they play. Same can't be said about many of the other lowly teams, particularly Udinese, for example, where every week they show me how fucking selfish they are. Now, in the 28th minute, Sule accidentally handled the ball in the area from hero to zero. Mancozu had to take the penalty. He stepped up and he smacked it into the crossbar. The ball fell to Yankto, who couldn't hit the target. So that was already one massive chance missed by Cagliari, who had the opportunity to equalize but could not capitalize on it. In the 38th minute, just 10 minutes later, Sule went on a solo run, twisted and turned past Dossena, that's the second time we're mentioning him, before slotting home calmly. So it's redemption again, of course. Two goals, gave away a penalty granted, but they failed to convert, so he's living in dreamland at this point. In the 43rd minute, Luvumbo played a perfect cross to Mancozu, whose header hit the woodwork. This is the second time he struck the bar this game after the penalty. So you can tell, you know, Cagliari hitting the post twice, trailing 2-0, they were still in it. They were still in it up until this point. So now it's half time. You can tell probably Ranieri was telling his boys, come on, you've been unlucky. We can do this. Don't concede another one. We're still in this game. Let's go out. Let's get them. 49th minute. Brescianini opens the second half by beating Dossena, third time, 1v1, and rolling the ball into the back of the net to make it 3-0. So at this point, I thought to myself, fuck, the game's over, and I'm just going to have to watch Frosinone defend a 3-0 lead while Cagliari fluff their chances. But that was far from being the case. Gabriele Zappa attempted to head the ball into the back of the net for Cagliari after a corner, but it was cleared off the line brilliantly by defender Monterisi. Now, this is another massive opportunity squandered by Cagliari. Luck was not on their side. However, they did not give up. In the 72nd minute, Pavoletti, who had just come on, played the ball to Aristanio, who had just come on loan from Inter. He curled it in absolutely beautifully with his left foot. This was another potential goal of the week contender. There were quite a few this week. Last week I commented that there weren't many crazy goals. Apparently they were all saving them for this week. In the 76th minute, shortly after, Berenchea, who is also on loan from Juventus, playing for Frosinone, gave the ball away clumsily. Well, to be honest, he played the ball in a tight space where he really shouldn't have been risking it, especially considering the fact that Cagliari had just scored and they were driven. He should have totally played the safer pass over there, just cleared the ball up. But it was intercepted by Makumbu, basically, who took full advantage, he drove forward, and he finished to make it 3-2. Now, all of a sudden, Cagliari are back into the game. They need one goal to get an equalizer, and there are 15 minutes plus added time remaining. The referee shortly after awarded a penalty to Cagliari for a foul by goalkeeper Turati on Pavoletti, who basically Superman dived and punched the ball out of his feet. Upon a VAR review, the penalty was overturned as Turati had clearly punched the ball first. Disappointment for Cagliari, but they did not give up. In the 94th minute, Nicolas Viola delivered a perfect corner to the head of Pavoletti, who got the equalizer with a header, of course. Pavoletti, if you know anything about Pavoletti, he comes on in the second half and he scores late headers. That's all he does. In fact, you know, they would say, "E se la metti, segna Pavoletti," which translates to, "If you put him on, Pavoletti will score." 2 minutes later, a long ball was played over the top. It was flicked down by Dossena. Okay, this is the fourth time we're mentioning him, and it's the only positive. Okay, massive contribution over here. He flicked the ball down to Pavoletti, who managed to get the ball over the line. Absolutely brilliant scenes. Now, some of you might ask, how the hell did this happen? How did it happen that they were losing 3-0 and then all of a sudden they take out some of their best players in Yankto and Luvumbo and Mankwazu and they come back not only to equalize but to win? And I would say that the substitutions that Ranieri made were very smart. Okay, so bringing on the likes of Nicolas Viola, Oristanio and Atzi gave you a nice mixture of like experience, young flair in Oristanio. You know, no one really knows what he's going to do. You know, young on loan from Inter, he comes on, he's driven, he's hungry. And he was the catalyst, in fact. He was the one to score the first goal. He was the one to give them hope. And not to mention Atzi as well, who's got a bit of experience under his belt as well. Not to mention that Frosinone are to blame as well. You know, they're victims of their own lack of composure, because when the goals started coming in, they panicked and they just kept coming in and in and in and in. And 4 goals in 20 minutes is just mental to concede. And I feel like the substitutes that had just come off were so shocked, they couldn't even get into the game. Like, you see, Burabia came on, Oyono came on, Garitano, Kedira, they didn't even know what to do. At one point, the 80th minute, he panicked, he brought on Okoli. He's like, fuck it, we need a defender over here. Nothing, it was all in vain, because Pavoletti absolutely destroyed them at the end. Another factor, of course, is the determination by Cagliari, okay? The fact that they were never out of it. Do you know what the players did when they scored in the 93rd minute? The equalizer, the 3-3. They ran to the ball, they grabbed the ball, they ran back to their half, and they placed the ball on the halfway line, ready to go score another one. Like, that's crazy. You just scored three to come back from 3-0 down to 3-3. You should be celebrating, you know, celebrating like it's a winner. No, no, that was not enough for them. They wanted to go all the way, and boy, did they. Now, I'm sure this victory will help Cagliari with their confidence. You know, they hadn't picked up a single victory all season. Just a couple of draws here and there. They currently sit in 19th with 6 points. Let's hope that this is a turning point for them. They even have Lapadula coming back, and I can't wait to see him, because he was absolutely bossing it in Serie B, and he's a leader also. You know, they've got a few nice options up front, not to mention Petagna, who hasn't even settled yet. I'm curious to see if he can do anything. As for Frosinone, this won't be the end of the world for them, as they had quite a strong start to the season, and they sit 12th with 12 points. Yeah, I don't think this will affect them too much. Hopefully, it will make them hungry and it will teach them a brutal lesson in composure and focus. Speaking of a brutal lesson in composure and focus, the next game we're going to be covering is Napoli 2, Milan 2. It unfolded as a spectacle, to be honest. It left both teams with mixed emotions, because Milan were totally devastated to throw their 2-0 lead away, while Napoli also looked disappointed by the fact that they didn't manage to get 3 points out of this one, despite being 2-0 down. Rudy Garcia approached the game with a 4-3-3 formation with Meret in goal, Di Lorenzo as the right back, Mario Rui as the left back, and Nathan and Rahmani as the center back duo. In the midfield, it was Elmas, Lobotka, and Zielinski, with Kvaratskhelia out on the left, Politano out on the right, and Giacomo Raspadori playing as a false nine. For Milan, it was the exact same formation, a 4-3-3. With Maignan in goal, Calabria as the right back, Theo Hernandez as the left back, with Tomori and Pierre Kalulu as the centre back duo. Reinders, Krunic and Musa were the midfield three, with Rafael Leao out on the left, Pulisic out on the right, and Olivier Giroud up front. Now, the game started off with Milan on the front foot, but they had bad news in the 19th minute as Pierre Kalulu, who was the third choice centre back, or fourth choice, arguably, if you think that Kier is ahead of him in the pecking order. I think it depends on the matchup. He fell injured and he will be out till 2024. And Marco Pellegrino, who has never played a Serie A game in his life, had to step in and replace him for his debut in the Maradona. Talk about a baptism of fire. Absolutely fucking stressful for him, stressful for everyone watching, and he looked nervous, and that's quite a shit way to start the game for Milan. Unfortunately for them, the the injury crisis does not hold up. But Milan started strongly, and in the 22nd minute, Pulisic played a great ball to Giroud, who converted. Shortly after, just 10 minutes later, Davide Calabria as well played a perfect ball to Giroud, who was on red-hot form, and he scored his second goal of the game. And at this point, we were wondering, oh my god, are Milan going to fucking smash Napoli at the Maradona yet again after last season's 4-0 smacking of the champions, quite frankly. But yeah, the first half ended with Milan up by two. And at halftime, Milan took out Christian Pulisic, who was also injured apparently, and brought on Luca Romero. So all of a sudden, you're playing with Pellegrino and Luca Romero, who are two relatively inexperienced players. Of course, Luca Romero having more experience playing with Lazio and featuring a few times with Milan. As for Napoli, they made three substitutions at the halfway mark. They brought on Ostigard to try to deal with Giroud a little bit better, Simeone to partner Raspadori up front so they can play with two up front, and Matias Oliveira to play on the wing instead of Mario Rui, perhaps offering a little bit more defensive solidarity against Romero. In this case, it would have been Christian Pulisic. But yes, it took till the 50th minute for Marco Pellegrino to be exposed. Of course, that's a little bit harsh, but Politano used his experience and his technique to absolutely destroy him when he went to head the loose ball, and Politano just flicked it over him, shimmied past Theo Hernandez and smacked it into the back of the net. Absolutely brilliant goal by him. And then later on, in the 63rd minute, Romero gave away a free kick just outside the area, which Raspadori took so brilliantly. He shot it to Maignan's near post. Maignan should have definitely done better. He set up a secondary wall to kind of cover the second post, but he... Sorry, his near post, but it proved to be redundant, as all it did was block his view, and Maignan should never have been beaten over there, quite frankly. The game featured quite a few missed chances as well, as in the first half. Politano received a square ball right in front of the goal, well, at an awkward angle, to be honest. He shot and he failed to hit the target. Calabria, when there was a flick on by Jovic later on, failed to score as well. And at the very end of the game, Kvaratskhelia should have scored the winner, but he missed when he was one-on-one with the goalkeeper. He was also squared the ball. A mixed bag, a total mixed bag over here. And I'm hearing shouts of Pioli out. This has been a very, very tough 2 weeks for Milan. When you look at the Juve game, when you look at the PSG game, when you look at this game now, and Pioli's being criticized, and not only by the fans, now it seems to be the players. So we've already seen this season the players criticizing his decision to take out Loftus-Cheek earlier on the season. You could see Leao and Theo Hernandez basically telling Pioli, why are you subbing him? He's strong. We need his physicality. Why are you taking him out? But Pioli, of course, stuck with his guns. This game, you see Giroud absolutely fuming at the fact that he's being substituted when he had already scored two goals and was in red hot form. And usually, I tend to say the opposite. Like, for example, when Milan were a man down against Juventus, and Pioli decided to keep Giroud on, I questioned that decision and I said, do you really want to keep on a relatively immobile player when you're a man down against Juventus and you want to attack? I thought that was a little bit bizarre personally. Now, in a game like this where you have a seasoned striker who's in the form of his life and you need goals, and you look at your alternative and your alternative is Jovic, who hasn't scored a goal for you, who hasn't even settled yet, it seems like the wrong decision to make. However, Pioli did say that if Jovic's flick on to Calabria had found its way into the back of the net, we would have been hailing him to be a genius. But unfortunately, we can only talk about and discuss things that have happened, Pioli. And this is it. This is what happened at the end of the day. You took out your two top goal scorers. Okay, so Pulisic was off at the start of the half with an injury, then he took off Leao and Giroud, who are the two other top scorers. Now, Leao was visibly pissed off as well, and he publicly said, I need an explanation from the coach as to why I was substituted. I can give him an explanation very easily. He played like a moron. He played stupidly. He was selfish. He was casual. And apart from running to the byline, he didn't really provide any form of threat. I do think that when it comes to stretching the game and beating men down the wing and taking the ball to the byline, Leao is absolutely incredible and he's one of the best in the world. And that is what has earned him his reputation, right? His ability to absolutely leave defenders in the mud as he takes off and knocks the ball forward and takes advantage of the space in front of him. However, he seems to think that he's better than he is, quite frankly, because I've never seen him score a goal from out of the box and he keeps trying them. He keeps trying these long-range shots. Like, what? Why? Play to your strengths. It's prima donna-esque, you know? Like, it's so frustrating at times. And then when you see him say, I want an explanation. The explanation should be that moment where you had Romero wide open and you attempted to trip the goalkeeper from out of the box when a goal was needed. Again, he had the opportunity to empower a youngster. He had the opportunity to play the ball to a player who's very smart, smart beyond his years. Like, granted, Romero's a youth player, but he's known for his IQ. You know, he wouldn't have wasted that opportunity if you gave him the ball over there. It's just very frustrating when it comes to Leao because he is clearly a freak of nature. He's physically stronger than everyone else. He's faster than everyone else. He's skillful. He's when it comes to dribbling, he's so smart. He knows where to put the ball. He knows where to feint. It comes naturally to him, you know. But sometimes I question his decision-making. I question his attitude at times as well. And it's clear to see, you know, I mean, everyone questions it and you have to be blind to stand for this because it's selfishness. And selfishness, that's costing the team points at this point. You know, honestly, if Chukwueze and Pulisic were both fit, I'd say start the next game with with them on the wings. But unfortunately, everyone's in hospital, so... So, Leao obviously can't be benched. And let's be real, Leao is a player that you have to keep happy because he is a world beater. But the coach does need to fucking grab him by the neck and put him in his place, I feel. As for Napoli, two fantastic goals, two goal of the week contenders on Serie A Spotlight. I highly doubt they give a fuck about that, but two fantastic goals. And good substitutions by Garcia to keep them in the game as well. Those three substitutions he made at halftime proved to be quite useful. The decision to start Elmas confused me, to be honest, but yeah, it all worked out in the end for them. I would say a draw is the deserved result over here. It was a game of two halves, the usual cliche. The first half was all Milan, the second half was all Napoli. And it could have gone any other way, to be honest. The margins were so fine towards the end with all the missed opportunities. Nathan got sent off at the end of the game, by the way, 89th minute. So Milan actually had a few minutes playing a man up. And Napoli actually got closer to scoring than Milan did at the end with that Kvaratskhelia miss. But alas, Milan find themselves in third with 22 points, 3 points off Inter in first, which isn't bad. It's not a bad start to the season at all. Milan are definitely still in this. The Pioli out crowd is back, and I feel like they've never really left. How do I feel about the whole Pioli out movement? I feel like tactically he can be a little bit stubborn at times. I feel like he sometimes doesn't read the game as well, especially when it comes to making substitutions. His in-game management can be questionable, and I always find myself wondering, why the hell did he bring him on and not him? Why did he take him out? You know what I mean? The season is long, however, and sacking him now would be absolutely mental, because you're not going to get a replacement that's better, and you risk disgruntling the dressing room. I say, unless there's a situation where Milan are about to miss out on top four, there should be no reason for Pioli to be sacked. Granted, then, at the end of the season, assess, go back to it and say, okay, there were these 3-0, there was a 3-0 loss over here, a 5-1 loss over there, a loss over here, a lead thrown over there. Do we want to continue with this guy? And at the end of the season, if you decide that that's not what you want to do, you sack him and you bring someone and you give him a full preseason and you do it properly. Not sacking a coach halfway through the season when you're third and still relevant in the Champions League, because let's be real, Milan aren't dead yet in the Champions League. Granted, they don't have a victory, they haven't scored a goal. They've got 3 games remaining in the group of death, and with the way the other games have turned out, the ball is still in Milan's court to a certain extent. Napoli sit in 5th with 18 points as they kind of figure themselves out with their new identity. I'm sure this result will give Napoli fans a little bit of faith in Garcia as a tactician. Perhaps not about the way he approached the game initially, but the way he adapted to it and eventually prevented a humiliating loss. Some of you might argue that Pioli did that himself, not Garcia, but anyway, let's remain positive over here. The good news for Napoli is that Victor Osimhen should be coming back in the near future, and he's obviously a massive asset to them, because playing without one of the best strikers in the world is obviously much harder than playing with one of the best strikers in the world. The next game I'm going to be talking about is Inter 1 Roma 0, and Roma over here really demonstrated what a negative, boring side they are. And I'm being nice over here, because Sassuolo approach games against Inter with a positive mentality, and they play their football and they try to score their goals, while Roma absolutely surrendered the ball and let Inter play and tried to take advantage of slip-ups or of half chances. And to be honest, they did get close to getting something out of this with a Cristante header at some point. But it's absolutely mind-boggling to me how a team like Roma approaches a game like against Inter in this manner. Having the ball for merely 19 minutes in the entire game, that's the least any club has held the ball this match day. The least. 19 minutes they had the ball for. Now, I know this is Mourinho's approach. I know, yes, okay, it almost worked. It's just so so boring to watch. You know, I love Mourinho nowadays. Didn't used to like him when I was younger, let's just say that. But nowadays I've grown to appreciate him as a man, as a character, and even historically for what he's done. But yeah, the football is absolutely brutal to watch. And Inter thankfully brought the spice over here. So for Inter, it was a 3-5-2 formation with Sommer in goal, Bastoni, Acerbi and Pavard at the back, with Di Marco on the left flank and the Dumfries on the right flank. Mkhitaryan, Çalhanoğlu and Barella were in the middle, with Lautaro Martinez and Thuram up front. For Roma, it was Rui Patricio on goal, Mancini, Llorente and Ndicka at the back with Cristante on the right, Zalewski on the left, Bove, Paredes and Cristante in the middle with Lukaku and El Shaarawy up front. This was Lukaku's first time back at San Siro after he refused to renew his contract with Inter. And not only that, he actually, I don't even think he was offered a contract with Inter because he was in talks with other teams before the Champions League final had even been played. So the fans resent him, the players resent him. Barella and Martinez were particularly cold towards him during the handshake at the beginning of the game. Fans had thousands of whistles at the stadium. I believe it was like 30,000 whistles or something. Plus, they had apps on their phone for those who didn't have a whistle. They could download a whistle app on their phone and they could actually use that instead. The sound was deafening from our TV, so let alone what it must have been like over there every time Lukaku touched the ball. Absolute carnage by the Inter fans. But yes, let's quickly run down how the game went. The first action was Çalhanoğlu smacking the crossbar from a distance. It would have been a fantastic goal. Rui Patricio had a one-on-one save on Thuram. Dimarco had a narrow miss with the outside of his foot. Pavard kept bombing into the box. That was an interesting thing we observed. And I think he actually had more touches in the box than Lukaku did in the entire game. More shots too, actually. Thuram missed a golden opportunity with his head still quite wasteful. Cristante headed the ball goalwards. And this was a very, very good shot on target for Roma. And it required a full stretch save by Sommer to stop that from going in. Çalhanoğlu took another long-range shot, which deflected and almost found its way into the back of the net, while Dimarco kept pelting in crosses. Obviously, you know how relentless he can be. Eventually, he delivered a low cross between the goalkeeper and the defense. It took up until the 81st minute for this to actually work, where Thuram was there to slot it in. And he scored the winning goal. Lukaku's replacement, right in front of Lukaku in Lukaku's stadium. While he's being whistled and everyone's cheering for him, it must have been absolutely horrible for Lukaku to watch that. Can you imagine? And I'm sure he hated every second of it, because he has demonstrated that he has a particularly large ego. Shortly after that, Carlos Augusto struck the ball venomously from way out and rattled the crossbar. And at the end of the game, Cristante had the ball from outside the area and he had a miracle attempt where he shot from long range but failed to hit the target. He actually skied it. I'm sure Inter have had tougher games than this. They created many chances and they were actually quite wasteful. If you look at the shooting stats over here, Inter had 19 shots to Roma's 3 and 63% ball possession. When it comes to shots on target, however, Roma kept it tight, so they actually didn't allow Inter many shots on target. They only had 3 shots on target, Inter, while Roma's 1 shot on target was probably the closest opportunity in the game that anyone got, who didn't score, of course. That header by Cristante, wow, what a save by Jan Sommer. I want to highlight quickly the importance of Dimarco, who, in my opinion, is one of the best left wing backs in world football. He is absolutely relentless. He is a playmaker. Inter tick through Dimarco. Don't get it twisted. It's all about Dimarco. He links the defense to the attack. He's the catalyst in this team. He's brilliant. Amazing player. I also want to congratulate Simone Inzaghi for trusting one of his players on a yellow card and not substituting him, as Alessandro Bastoni got a yellow card in the 64th minute, and that would usually mean that in the 70th minute he'd be subbed off. But he actually left him on until the end of the game, so congratulations Simone Inzaghi in trusting your man, something you are not very used to doing. When it comes to Roma, I forgot to mention that Mourinho wasn't actually on the bench because he's serving a suspension, as always. It was the assistant manager who was there, and it would have been entertaining to see Mourinho at San Siro, even though he's usually well behaved over there because the Inter fans absolutely love him because he won the treble with them. But yeah, it is looking quite bleak for Roma in these big games. They really don't turn up. They currently sit in 9th with 14 points. And I think Obviously, their European aspirations are alive and well, and even a Champions League spot is up for contention for them. But they are going through a little bit of an injury crisis, and with their best players back, hopefully we'll get to see them playing more expressive football, not just pragmatic, defensive, counter-attacking, opportunistic football that they're playing right now. Inter, on the other hand, sit comfortably in first with 25 points. 2 points ahead of Juventus in second, as they continue to show that they are a force to be reckoned with in this league. Let's talk about Lazio 1, Fiorentina 0. This was a Monday night clash in the 10th round of Serie A, and it took up until the 95th minute for the game to be decided, and it was absolutely beautiful the way it was decided, because at one point late into the second half, the fans in the Olympico started chanting "Ciro, Ciro," basically summoning their all-time leading goal scorer in Ciro Immobile. Kind of unfair on Castellanos, who was having a great game, but of course they want to see their talisman and the man who has changed so many games for them. Obviously, Ciro Immobile came on, and Lazio were given a penalty at the end of the game, and he converted it to win the game. You know, football is all about these moments for me. You know, like Thuram scoring in front of Lukaku, the contrast between Thuram's night and Lukaku's night. The fact that the fans have so much power. They call for a player, the coach brings him on, and they empowered him so much that there was no doubt that Ciro Immobile was ever going to miss the penalty. And you can tell Patrick that he didn't have to look away, because Ciro Immobile hardly ever misses penalties. He's a fantastic penalty taker. But yeah, football is poetry, and football imitates art, which imitates life. And that's just beautiful, man. But yeah, we should probably get into the lineups. For Lazio, it was the usual 4-3-3 formation, with Provedel in goal, Lazzari, Patrick, Romagnoli and Marusic at the back, with Guendouzi, Rovella and Luis Alberto in the middle. Zaccagni was out on the left, Felipe Anderson was out on the right, with Castellanos starting up front, the ever-impressive Castellanos. He's looking better and better. For Fiorentina, it was Terracciano in goal in their 4-2-3-1 formation, with Biraghi, Milenkovic, Martinez, Quaradà and Parisi at the back, Arthur and Duncan in the double pivot, with Ikone, Bonaventura and Gonzalez playing behind Lucas Beltran. You know, the home side started the game strongly, of course, being Lazio. They had a missed opportunity by Luis Alberto, who was set up really nicely by Tati Castellanos. You had Guendouzi trying and playing the ball into the box. You had Beltran, actually, in the 12th minute, who scored offside. He was played a marvellous ball over the top, but he controlled it with his arm. He showed great technique, though, to take the ball down with his arm and round the goalkeeper and score. It took VAR for the referee to call that goal off. He did hit the post later on. He hit the post, and then the ball ricocheted off Provedel and back into play. And at the end of the half, there was a little bit of drama, actually, as Ikone seemed to be dropped in the box. However, the ref seemed to think otherwise, as he did not give the penalty. Luis Alberto had a particularly poor game, I feel, this game. Felipe Anderson displayed some good moments where he got the ball at one point in the box and turned and shot so brilliantly, forcing the goalkeeper into a reflex save. But yeah, Lazio were looking much better in this game. And Sarri did comment. He said that it's a shame that Kamada can't get more minutes with Alberto on the pitch, because apparently their characteristics do not complement each other and they are too similar. You know, Luis Alberto is a fantastic player on his day. Daichi Kamada, you can clearly tell that there's talent over there. But this is just the thing with Sarri. You know, I remember him saying that Milinkovic-Savic and Luis Alberto can't play well together. And he ended up utilizing them until SMS went off to Saudi Arabia. But yeah, we'll see. I'm sure he'll figure things out. Daichi Kamada is too good to be kept on the bench. And you can't obviously bench Luis Alberto, because he's become a leader in this team. At the end of the game, it was Milenkovic, who handled the ball, the big Serbian defender, in the box. The referee pointed to the spot, and it was Immobile who stepped up, of course, shot the ball low and hard to the left. The goalkeeper went the wrong way, and Lazio took home all 3 points. Lazio seemed to be on good form. They seem to be recovering. They've won 4 out of their last 5 matches, and they have climbed up to 7th with 16 points. As for Fiorentina, they are in 6th, 1 point ahead of Lazio with 17 points, as now they've got 2 losses in a row. They have a bit of, they're going through a bit of a slump right now, but obviously this tends to be the case. Both teams are trying to balance European football and the Serie A. They're both trying to play to their high standards, and sometimes it can bite you in the ass. Like Fiorentina's loss last week was, you know, they, in Maltese there's an expression, tislo finishef, you slip where it's dry, and Fiorentina definitely slipped where it was dry last week. A loss to Lazio is forgivable and excusable. Granted, perhaps it was a little bit harsh. They had many opportunities. They had a goal that was ruled out. They had a penalty call. They lost to a last minute penalty. They had 7 shots on target to Lazio's 3 shots on target. You know, it's a bit of a bitter pill to swallow, but yeah, I'm sure they'll bounce back. The next game I'm going to be covering is Juventus 1, Verona 0. Juve lined up with a 3-5-2 formation with Szczesny in goal, Rugani, Bremer and Gatti at the back, with Kostic out on the left and way out on the right, with Rabiot, Locatelli and McKennie in the middle. Moise Kean and Dusan Vlahovic formed a striking partnership up front. For Verona, Marco Baroni's men lined up with a 3-4-1-2 formation with Montipo in goal, Terracciano, Davidovic and Magnani at the back, with Faroni out on the right, Doig on the left, Hongla, Folorunsho and Duda playing in the middle, with Juric and Bonazzoli up front. In the 12th minute of the match, Moise Kean scored a fantastic goal, but the goal was disallowed because he had been offside in the build-up play by a stud. Harsh, very, very harsh over there, and it drew a lot of attention. Should the goal have stood? Was it onside? You know, at the end of the day, people are arguing that it was so close that the goal should have been given. However, where do you draw the line? I feel like the offside rule could be one of those that's black or white, you know. Pun intended. Let's just say it was intended because of Juve, of course. it was offside, you know, marginally, and as close a call as it's going to get. But we can't make exceptions like this, you know, unless the rule is changed entirely. I do like the idea of the offside rule favoring the striker, so that if the striker is in line with the defender, it's onside regardless of if he's ahead of him or not. However, that is not the rule at the moment. The rule states that if the defender is ahead, if the striker is ahead of the defender when the ball is played, then that's offside. And unfortunately, with that being the rule, this is offside. Now, maybe for the next game, Moise Kean will have to wear a shoe size smaller. Yeah, Juve got close again through Moise Kean in the first half, and Bonazzoli had an opportunity towards the end of the first half where he forced Szczesny into a great save. Moise Kean scored again in the second half, but this time it was ruled out for a foul, and this was absolutely ridiculous. Okay, Juve were hard done in this game. this was a very harsh foul to give, as he barely made contact with the player. Ruled off, and it seemed like Juve were not going to get the 3 points over here. However, at the end of the game, in the 96th minute, Gatti whipped the ball into the box, Milik headed it into the bar, and Cambiaso scored the rebound to give Juve a dramatic 1-0 victory at the death against Verona, a victory that was well-deserved. Juve absolutely dominated Verona, taking 30 shots to Verona's 7. Juve had 6 shots on target this game, while Verona only had that one Bonazzoli attempt, and they deserved the victory. It would have been extremely harsh if they didn't get all 3 points, considering the nature of the goals that were called off. But yeah, Juve won and temporarily entered first place. With Inter's victory, that sees Juventus in second place with 23 points, while Hellas Verona are in 16th with 8 points, just 1 point outside the relegation pool. I also forgot to point out that there was a penalty call on Chiesa as well, so that would have made it even more controversial, if it could get any more controversial than it currently was at the time. Chiesa's influence off the bench was absolutely amazing, adding energy and chaos and attacking the Verona goal on multiple occasions. For the Empoli 0 Atalanta 3 game, this was a fantastic game to come home to after work on a Monday. Empoli lined up with a 4-3-3 formation with Berisha in goal. This was, of course, a potential banana slip for Atalanta, as Empoli have got their shit together since the reappointment of Andrea Zoli. Ebuehi, Walukovic, Luperto and Cacalcio were at the back, with Marin, Grassi and Maleh in the middle, with Cambiaghi out on the right, Cancelleri out on the left and Caputo up front. For Atalanta, in their new third kit, which is red and lovely, Juan Musso was in goal, Kolasinac, Jim City and Scalvini were at the back, with Ruggeri on the left, Hans Hatteber on the right, making his return. He used to be a regular starter, and that's how we remember him on the great Atalanta side. Ederson and Martin Deroon were in the middle, with Coop Miners playing behind Scamacca and Lookman. The first half witnessed Atalanta's complete domination, as evidenced by their overwhelming possession and attacking prowess, quite frankly. Scamacca's goal early on in the game set the tone for Atalanta's attacking intent, with his creative backheel flick, nutmeg flick, ensuring a well-deserved lead. Atalanta's overall superiority was underscored by Scamacca's attacking prowess. The Italian was on fine form this game and played a pretty much flawless game. He also went on to almost score again, just near miss over there, and then scoring a goal which was chalked off for offside. Scamacca also went on to set up Tion Koopmeiners, who scored with a well-placed finish and then scored another goal in the second half thanks to an assist by Martin Deroon in the 51st minute. Empoli got close through Cambiaghi, but Atalanta's offensive onslaught was simply too much for them, and at the end of the day it was quite an easy win for Atalanta, who had 56% ball possession and 18 shots to Empoli's 9. 6 shots on target for Atalanta to Empoli's 2. As for the league standings, Atalanta are in 4th place with 19 points, while Empoli are in 18th place with 7 points. Despite their lowly standings, there's a clear improvement over there. Atalanta continue to push for Europe, as they do look very good this year. And they've got some good depth and some quality players. Once they get ticking, they might really be a force to be reckoned with, and I do think they'll be a contender for top four and playing in the Champions League next season. We had a derby this match day between Sassuolo and Bologna. It was an Emilian derby, and this was where our goal of the week was scored, of course. Wildly inconsistent start for Sassuolo, who have beaten Juventus and Inter but failed to pick up a single victory in the last 3 rounds. Their lineup this week was Andrea Consigli in goal in their 4-2-3-1 formation, with Tolian, Erlich, Ferrari and Vigna at the back, Bolocca and Thordsvet in the middle, with Berardi, Bayrami and Laurenta playing behind Pinamonti. For Bologna, it was Skorupski in goal in their 4-3-1 formation, basically mirroring Sassuolo. Lico Giannis, Calafiori, Bonifazi and De Silvestri were at the back, with Abisher and Freuler playing in the double pivot, with Alexis Salamakers out on the left, Riccardo Orsolini out on the right, Lewis Ferguson playing behind Joshua Zirkzee. Sassuolo's offensive tactical configuration allowed them to maintain a strong presence in the opponent's half, creating several goal-scoring opportunities, especially through the efforts of Berardi and Pinamonti. Sassuolo attempted to control the midfield, emphasizing the importance of maintaining possession and creating cohesive attacking movements to penetrate Bologna's defense. On the other hand, Bologna took a more defensive approach. They were looking to thwart Sassuolo's attacking threats and minimize their goal-scoring chances. Bologna strategically focused on keeping everything tight, and players like Skorupski and Calafiori did very well to disrupt Sassuolo's rhythm and limit their ability to play sustained attacks. Despite Bologna's initial defensive posture, they also sought opportunities for quick counterattacks to capitalize on any defensive lapses from Sassuolo, an opportunistic approach over there from Motta. The game actually started with Sassuolo's attempts, many attempts for Sassuolo, including a close chance for Bayrami. However, Bologna quickly took the lead through a brilliant trademark play by Zirkzee, who skillfully evaded the defenders to score a stylish goal. His back heel control was to die for. You should totally go watch that if you haven't. Despite Sassuolo's efforts, the first half saw them struggling to convert their possession into concrete goal-scoring opportunities. The second half witnessed both teams making strategic substitutions. While Sassuolo intensified their attacks, Bologna also attempted to increase their tempo. The match continued with moments of back-and-forth action, with Sassuolo's Bolocca eventually scoring an equaliser with a well-placed shot from outside the box. Another potential goal of the week contender. There were many this week. The game saw further attempts from both sides, with Zirkzee initially scoring another goal, which was disallowed due to Orsolini's offside position. A few crucial saves by Skorupski saw the game end 1-1, with Bologna in 8th with 15 points, while Sassuolo are down in 15th with 11 points. Yeah, a draw here was, I think, the fair result. 5 shots on target for each team, Bologna dominating the possession, even though watching the game, it totally didn't feel like that was the case. I mean, how the hell did Bologna have 60% ball possession? It felt like Sassuolo were more involved than that. But yeah, it was an interesting watch, and yeah, fair draw over here. We'll be moving on to Monza Udinese, which ended 1-1 for Monza. It was Di Gregorio in goal, Carboni, Mari, and Calderola at the back, with Kyriakopoulos on the left, Churio on the right, with Pessina and Gagliardini in the middle, Vignato and Colpani played behind Colombo. For Udinese, it was a 3-5-2 formation with Silvestri in goal, Perez, Biol and Cabalese at the back, with Ebosele out on the right and Zamora out on the left, with Paiero, Wallace and Samardzic in the middle. Success and Pereira were up front. Now, Monza got an early lead orchestrated by Colpani, and it aligned with the team's strategic approach, to be honest. With the absence of Itzo and Ambrosio in defence, the inclusion of Carboni was obviously necessary. The structured offensive setup, spearheaded by Vignato and Colpani, posed a significant threat to Udinese's defensive line. And in fact, the first half was all Monza, as they had 57% ball possession and 3 shots on target to Udinese's nil. However, the second half saw Udinese making a few tactical changes, bringing on Camara, Lovric, Lucca and Ferreira, and they easily grew into the game. Their substitutions brought in a lot of energy, and as the game progressed, both teams continued to make more tweaks in pursuit of a decisive breakthrough. Monza's tactical adjustments included the introduction of Bondo and Carvalho, sought to fortify their defensive strategies, while Udinese brought on, of course, offensive players that I mentioned earlier. A ball over the top that wasn't dealt with by Monza, so Lucca at the far post, executing a perfect poacher's finish over there, the 6'7" striker. Hardly ever scores with his head, because his technique is just that good that he doesn't need to. When you have a player who's that tall with so much technique, it's always fun to watch. Udinese are one of the most selfish teams in the league, and I hate watching them, quite frankly, because players like Lovric, for example, towards the end of the game, had a player wide open, but he went for the shot. Absolutely disgusting. There's a situation like this every single week with Udinese. I don't know if it's, you know, there's an expression that says a fish rots from the head down. And this applies perfectly, to be honest, because Udinese's ownership doesn't seem to be investing in the club. And if they don't see any value in the club, then I highly doubt the players do. So the players might view this team as a stepping stone in their career, or as an opportunity to stat pad a few personal stats. And that seems to be the case with Udinese, unfortunately, at the moment. We all know that their owners also own Watford, so they do have other interests and priorities. Udinese sit in 17th with 7 points. They have actually drawn 7 games, so they don't lose very often. They never win. They have 0 wins. They've lost 3 times, but they've drawn 7 times. As for Monza, who are way more impressive, and their project is lovely compared to Udinese, especially. They sit in 10th, perfectly mid-table, with 13 points. They've won 3, they've lost 3, and they've drawn 4. So yeah, despite Udinese's lackluster start and the fact that they've sacked a manager already, they're actually a very solid team when it comes to their defensive setup, and teams are struggling to beat them. So I highly doubt they'll get relegated, and will keep seeing them slowly deteriorate until they do. I predict within the next 5 years, if it's the same ownership, they will go down to Serie B. As for Lecce Torino, where Torino beat Lecce away from home with a score of 1-0 thanks to a goal by Buongiorno on his return, the lineups involved Lecce's 4-3-3 formation with Falcone in goal, Jondre, Pongracic, Bascherotto and Gallo at the back, with Rafia, Ramadani and Gonzalez in the middle, with Almqvist and Banda on the wings, with Kristovic up front. For Torino, it was Vanya Milinkovic-Savic in goal in a 3-5-2 formation, with Ricardo Rodriguez, Buongiorno and Vojvoda at the back, Lazaro and Bellanova on the wings, Gilinetti and Ginaitis in the middle, Pellegri and Sanabria up front. Now, the game started off and it was all Lecce with missed opportunities from Banda and Kristovic and Almqvist. They were really pushing to get the lead. But in the 40th minute, Buongiorno got on the end of a cross and smashed the ball into the roof of the net. In the second half, Torino seems to have settled into the game nicely and their defensive cohesion was clear to see. They created the better chances in the second half and Lecce slowly faded out and didn't have anything to answer to this Torino side. These two teams are both very exciting. We all know and we have discussed many times on this podcast that Juric is facing a few problems, especially when it comes to getting the team ticking offensively. Maybe he should start playing Buongiorno as a striker. As for Lecce, of course, you know that we are enamored by them over here. We are big fans of Almqvist, Kristovic, Banda, Strefezza, all these guys. They're all so much fun to watch. And they did put on a show at the beginning of the game before they kind of fizzled out. Juric got sent off towards the end of the game for a foul on Bellanova that seemed to injure him. He got sent off for complaining, of course. As he's the manager, I made it sound over there like Juric ran onto the pitch, fouled Bellanova and got sent off. Trust me, this was not the case. Torino currently sit in 13th with 12 points, while Lecce sit in 11th with 13 points. 10 match days in and this table is really taking shape. Curious to see what happens and curious to see what Matty has to say about this, my co-host. I can't wait for him to be back, because I must say that doing this alone is way less interesting than doing it with him. The final game I'm going to be talking about was Genoa 1, Salernitana 0. This saw Alberto Gilardino facing Filippo Inzaghi, two men who have won a Champions League trophy together. Genoa lined up with Josep Martinez in goal in their 3-5-2 formation, with Dragosin, Bani and Vasquez at the back, Sabelli and Martin on the wings, with Malinovski, Badel and Frendrup in the middle. Retegui and Goodmanson were the striking partnership. For Filippo Inzaghi Salernitana, it was a 3-4-2-1 formation with Ochoa in goal, Pirola, Gyomber and Lovato at the back, with Brotherich and Mazzocchi on the wings, Koulibaly and Maggiore in the middle, with Cabral and Candreva playing behind Dia. Genoa created several close goal-scoring opportunities early on. Both Badel and Retegui hit the post in the opening minutes, reflecting Genoa's strong offensive intent from the get-go. However, Retegui's performance was cut short as he had to leave the field due to a recurring knee injury. So sad to see over here. I really hope we get to see him at his best, as he's a very exciting striker. Despite the setback, Genoa continued to dominate the game, with Goodmanson eventually scoring a crucial goal, exploiting an assist from Malinovski, which would have also been a potential goal of the week contender. In the second half, the tactical adjustments made by both teams significantly impacted the game. Salernitana shifted to a 3-4-2-1 formation, introducing Sambia and Bohinen to create a more balanced midfield. This change allowed Salernitana to take advantage of Genoa's slightly lower tempo and exploit the absence of Retegui. However, their efforts to equalize were hindered by Genoa's resilient defense, led by the strategic substitutions of the brilliant and promising manager Alberto Gherardino, who brought on Kutlu and Strutman to reinforce the team's stability. While Salernitana attempted to push forward and create goal-scoring opportunities, their efforts were thwarted by a lack of creativity and precision in the final third. Despite Mazzocchi hitting the crossbar later in the game, Salernitana failed to convert their chances into goals, and it reflected their struggles to find the right approach in the attacking phase under both Sousa and now under Inzaghi. In contrast, Genoa, although under pressure, managed to withstand Salernitana's late surge, emphasizing the importance of defensive solidarity in this Genoa team. Albert Gudmundsson is fantastic. I always say this, he is way too good to be playing at Genoa, unfortunately for Genoa and their fans. I see him leaving as early as January. He's got a case going on in Iceland right now, a case of abuse. So I think big teams will want that to blow over before signing him. I believe that's the reason he's not included in the Iceland national team. He tried to dribble the entire world in the 90th minute, Gudmundsson. So despite him being fantastic at the end of the game, he had players open, but he kept going. And I did think that he was going to manage to dribble the entire team. But he lost the ball and the counter-attack. So Dia almost scoring at the end of it. He had Ekuban wide open, and the fans have been booing Ekuban, and that's very, very tough to watch, as Gudmundsson had an opportunity to empower his teammate, but he decided to almost cost his team the game instead. I do think that the booing of Ekuban is very unfair, because he's a player who, despite his lack of quality perhaps, always gives his all. And that's what you need from your players. No, you need your players to give their best. I mean, you can protest against the club signing the player, but booing the player when he's trying his best leaves a bad taste in my mouth. At the end of the day, his replacement is Puskas. And Puskas, I believe, might be even worse than he is. So be careful who you boo. The fans have an opportunity to lift their players and to fill them with confidence. And a confident player will obviously make the difference. Instead, they're taking the approach of booing him when Retegui can barely stay fit to play. They're going to need Ekuban. They better change their approach. So that is it for match day 10, and we'll be moving on to our question segment. If it's your first time here, welcome to our question segment. This is where we take listener questions and hot takes. You can drop voice notes, you can drop your opinions on Twitter or on Instagram. You can find us at Serie A Spotlight, and we will be sure to discuss them. Our first hot take comes from Alessio on Twitter at AM Juve. He says, "I don't know if this is a hot take, but I'm loving the performances of Joshua Zirkzee so far this season. He's made huge steps to becoming a top striker in the league." Yes, we've been singing Zirkzee's praises since the start of this podcast, saying that it's clear what Bayern Munich had seen in him, because he is a Bayern Munich talent. However, his finishing has always disappointed him, and it seems that he's been taking a different approach when it comes to his finishing, opting for precision and intelligence instead of power. He's smart enough to move his body in a way to deceive the opponent and goalkeepers, and he often leaves goalkeepers flat-footed as he just rolls the ball past them. His development has been fantastic, and he's having a fantastic season. I do think that he would be a good fit at a big club, for example a team like Milan, who need a striker who thrives at hold-up play. He might be perfect, who knows, but if he keeps scoring goals at this rate, he's definitely not gonna come cheap. Frank, our loyal listener, love you, Frank. He says, "Based purely on form, does Keane now start ahead of either Chiesa or Vlahovic? If yes, who drops out?" I think Keane's form is fantastic, and I think he's putting Vlahovic to shame. I think a spell on the bench for Vlahovic might not be a bad thing for Juve right now with the form Keane's in. Chiesa's impact off the bench is always very good. He brings a lot of energy, so maybe using him as an impact sub could be good for Juve. However, good luck explaining that to the player and trying to keep the player happy. So I think in theory, when you look at the big profiles of Vlahovic and Chiesa, it's going to be hard to bench them. I think they could play with maybe Keane alongside Vlahovic for the time being. William on Twitter asks, can you touch on Matthias Sule? Of course we can touch on Matthias Sule. We often talk about him on this podcast. He is a fantastic youngster. He's only 20 years old and he's owned by Juventus. Juventus bought him nice and young from a team called Kimberley. Don't ask me anything about Kimberley. I don't know anything about them, but he is from Argentina and has featured for Argentina at under 16, under 21 and under 20 level. Last season, he scored his first ever goal for Juventus and his only goal for Juventus. He's had 15 appearances for them. And this year, he's become a prolific player and a star at Frosinone with 8 games and 5 goals. I think his play style is quite similar to Domenico Berardi, where he's got that kind of largish frame. He's 6 feet tall. And he's very hardworking and technical and has a certain amount of flair to his game, which is always fun to watch. He's extremely exciting, and I do hope that he continues to develop like this. The question is, is Juventus the right environment for this guy to continue developing? In a 4-3-3, he thrives. Frosinone play a fantastic, attractive, positive brand of football, and definitely contrasts Juventus's approach starkly. Leo Messi asks a question on Instagram. I asked for his name, but he preferred to not share it. So he asked to be referred to as the cool, mysterious Leo Messi. He asks, did Fiorentina get robbed against Lazio? I don't think it was a robbery. No, if you are referring to the penalty call on Icone, I don't think there was enough in it for it to be given a penalty. Icone seemed to already be falling when the defender put his hand on his shoulder. I wouldn't say they got robbed. They were unlucky, but definitely not robbed. I would also like to give a shout out to Andy Chrétien, who DM'd us telling us that he had a bet on Keane to score over, for Keane to score and for Juve to get over 1.5 goals against Hellas Verona. If anyone's been robbed, it was definitely Andy. And also shout out to our boy Jake for showing us how to do Viola's celebration from the last episode. Thanks to you, I have finally managed. Thank you for listening, guys. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to DM us, to rate us, to sign up to our Patreon, to support us and to be added to our WhatsApp chat. You know the drill. Goodbye. I'm feeling like a star, yeah.